Hi, everyone. My name is Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome back. Hasn't been too long since we last talked. We had Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net for a very interesting conversation on. We got posted on, Thursday, and this was a great conversation is being posted today. It's a 2 in 2 days. Imagine that. Mike Bond of MMA Junkie happened to be available, so we talked for about 45 minutes or so about all types of MMA stuff, for lack of a better explanation. Let's see what we talked about. We talked about Fight Island. We talked about the UFC 251 card, DC Stipe 3, whether that is the fight for the right to be named or called the best UFC heavyweight of all time, the Conor McGregor third retirement, whatever you want to call it. And then also a lot about Dana White and this interview he did for ESPN First Take the other day, which was something to behold. And if you have not found that, seek it out immediately. It's available on YouTube. It is it's quite something. So yeah, if you haven't watched that yet or heard that yet, definitely check that out before you get into this podcast right here. So without further ado, let's get to it. Myself, Mike Bond, MMA news, UFC news, talk, all the good stuff. Let's hit it. My guest at this time is someone that is very familiar with the sunny skies of California, especially that the southern variety. He is someone that has been with the University of Southern California for years and years and years. A lot of controversy about whether he's going to retain the one and only Clay Helton as a head football coach there. But thankfully brought back Reggie Bush and OJ Mayo, reinstating them after many years away. The one and only Mike Bond is here. And Mike, how's recruiting going? How's the prospects of the season going? And how are things going overall?
Tough times right now for us all. We're not in school, but hey, we'll get back to it.
And so the reason for those people that don't know, this is Mike Bond of MMA Junkie, not Mike Bond of USC. I say that because when was this? This was back in December. I saw this. You probably retweeted the story or what have you, but... Yeah. So there's a Mike Bond of USC, who is the athletic director there, as I just mentioned. There was a big push to get their head football coach, Clay Helton, fired. And they were hitting up our friend on the phone here instead of the actual real Mike Bond. I thought that was pretty funny stuff.
Yeah, man. It's so this Mike Bond, like, I've had this happen not on this level since he went to USC, because he used to be athletic director at Cincinnati or University of Cincinnati, I believe. So you would get like the occasional little message sent to the wrong Twitter account or whatever. But when he made the move over to USC, it somehow got some added traction. I started getting emails from people and a lot more tweets and stuff. And like occasionally I'll just like retweet a hateful one or whatever the case may be. And then I got this long email from this one person being like, you know, I've been donating to the program for years. Like, we've been supporting it. We've been doing this, that, like, you know, we have so much invested in this, and like, you really need to fire this coach. And like, I hope you'll heed my advice, et cetera, et cetera. And I posted that email on my Twitter because I just thought it was so funny. And then a reporter from the LA Times reached out to me and basically said, you know, we find this is to be a pretty funny story that could work for our website, just about kind of obviously the mistaken identity. So I did an interview with them kind of talking about my experience dealing with this guy's hate over the past however many years. So that ended up making it, you know, onto the website and stuff. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Jesus. It's like the John Jones, who we had on this show, the other John Jones, who owns the Twitter handle. And he's had a lot of fun with the fact that he, you know, every time John Bones Jones comes up, he tends to get all this hate towards him and DMs and all this stuff. And he has a lot of fun with it. So it was interesting seeing a media member have to deal with the same treatment to a little bit lesser extent.
We know John Jones probably gets much more cruel messages than I, and a lot more frequent, considering his other John Jones seemingly puts him in the line of fire a little more often. I don't know how much more I'm going to be getting coming my way. It's probably going to be very infrequent, but yeah, definitely pretty funny, the old John Jones. And I think there's a Daniel Cormier out there somewhere too.
Yeah, I tried actually to John Jones actually knows Daniel Cormier, and we're trying to actually get him on this podcast when I did the John Jones interview, but he's a little bit more of a recluse, didn't really want to be known for that type of thing. So have you been in any contact with the other Mike Bond about any of this?
No, never. He doesn't really seem to be too, you know, interactive with people on social media, anything like that. So I don't know. I don't really see any purpose, but I'd love when I'm in California to like go down there and go to a football game or something and maybe try to drop into his office or something. I think that'd be pretty funny.
That'd be a riot. So there's a bunch of news to talk about. I did want to ask you about, obviously you've covered the NBA before for Rolling Stone and big NBA fan. And it appears we're coming back in late July. If I get the dates right, and in a very strange year, it's going to be a very strange end of the season, but I assume you are fairly excited about the NBA and especially your Raptors returning to action.
Yeah, for sure. They will get their chance to repeat, I guess. We don't know how good the odds are of that. There's some good teams out there this year. But yeah, I mean, it's nice to have it back for sure. It's obviously going to be a dramatic change from what we're used to. I'm used to being able to walk literally like 5 minutes across the street and go to an arena, you know, 2-3 nights a week when they're having a homestand and be in an arena with, you know, 18,000 people or something like that. And that's just not, seems like such a old, you know, part of our world. It's just so far removed from that. But yeah, this is going to be no crowd. Going to be pretty interesting to just see how the whole thing eventually unfolds. But I'm glad they're definitely back and got something done and they're able to give the athletes an opportunity to compete, the fans an opportunity to watch. And obviously, you know, this has been a very hard season for the NBA as well, obviously with Kobe Bryant's death and David Stern's death and everything. So I think it is fitting that they get to wrap up the season. I think it would have been pretty unfortunate if they didn't end up getting to go through with it, even though regardless of what happens, there's going to be a bit of an asterisk next to whoever wins it.
The China controversy feels like 10 years ago.
Man, everything feels like 10 years ago at this point. Like, I was just, the last time I was at a UFC event, I'm sure we'll get into that, or even at a basketball game, I think was, you know, mid-February, and that just feels so long ago. It's crazy.
What have you been doing to stay active in Toronto?
We've had really good weather in these past few weeks. So I live kind of on the waterfront area. So there's like a lot of bike paths and running paths and walking paths in that area. So I literally, like 2 minutes before we started recording here, I walked in the door from like a walk on the waterfront there. It's crazy hot today. I think it's like 80 degrees out or so. So it's getting up there in terms of temperature. So yeah, I just try to do that and obviously like little home workouts and stuff like that, but no gyms open still, nothing like that. So it's kind of take it upon yourself, go biking, play games in the park with your friends, little things like that. But it hasn't been too bad, honestly. I think it's almost forced me to get into a more sturdy routine of being active than I was in before. So I guess there is some upsides to it, but it'd be nice to be able to have the actual weights in a gym. I'm missing that for sure.
Yeah. I agree. It's funny. I was talking last week. I had on Greg Oliver, who is also in Toronto, now the owner of SlamWrestling.net, and we were just talking about how I love the city, Toronto, so much. John Pollock, who you recently did a podcast with and know pretty well, The city is just so great. I don't work for the tourism division there or anything like that. But every time I talk to someone from Toronto, I have to tell like how much I love the city. You mentioned walking around. The last time I was there, it's just such an easy city to walk around, just all types of things to do. It's great. So looking forward to getting back there. So consider yourself lucky. You have at least some access to some things up there, you know?
Yeah, we're still very much in our like phase one, though. We're a lot behind other parts of Canada. Like a lot of my family is in BC and they have like little to no COVID cases left. I think they have like one new case reported last week or something. So they're almost like completely open back up on that part of the country in British Columbia. Like people are going to restaurants. They can do a lot of different stuff out here. We are still very much in lockdown. There's, you know, no going into restaurants, even with limited seating. It's all takeout. Mm-hmm. The malls are still closed, all that kind of stuff. So it's, I think they are talking about all that stuff isn't even going to progress to the next phase till like June 26th. So we still have a couple more weeks of dealing with, you know, this kind of lockdown. And then who knows? I mean, we're still getting a lot of new COVID cases popping up. So I don't really know what the future of Toronto is in terms of being able to get back to its full strength. I think it might be a while still.
Before we get into the MMA talk, before we started, I caught a quick glimpse of your office and you had the Michael Jordan jersey. I was curious what you thought about the Last Dance documentary series.
I thought it was great, man. Like, I was obviously a little kid when all that stuff was going on. I mean, I was born in 1991. So, like, I have very vague memories of, like, those later seasons. But in terms of the early stuff, I obviously didn't get to experience that firsthand. So getting back, you know, going back and being able to have that story told, obviously, you know, you can agree with how some of the production does in terms of how they presented some people and whatnot. But I thought it was incredibly compelling. I was excited to watch every new episode that came out, and it was, you know, gave me a lot of information and a lot of visuals of stuff that I didn't get to experience in person. So I enjoyed it. What about you?
I really liked it as well. And I'm a little bit older than you are. So that was my, really my young, you know, teenage years and the 90s basketball it's so hard to explain to people that are just later generations. For those people that lived through the 90s, and it was just so much fun to watch. There were so many different teams. There were so many different teams that matter, I should say, and like interesting stars on these teams. And it was a really fascinating time. I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it back then. And anything, I think, you know, my friends who are, you know, similar age, all kind of agree. It was just pure nostalgia. Like, it was so great just to see the, because we lived through that era and we were rooting against the Bulls during that time. And it was just to kind of see everything, how it took you back to like those NBA final series. And that was, I mean, there wasn't things like Netflix around and streaming services and YouTube to kind of distract away. If you were a sports fan, those are things that you were watching, and you definitely had rooting interests and just to kind of follow along the stories. I remember when the Jordan Rules book came out, and there was just, it was really, when Jordan played baseball, that whole thing, like, it was just a real, real fun walk down memory lane during this time when, like, that to me, when I was a kid, that was all that mattered was sports. And to kind of see that story get brought back all these years later with all the footage and all that stuff, it was, especially the Dream Team stuff I loved, it was really enjoyable. I mean, for those that lived through that era, I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I was a little past, I mean, my earliest NBA memories are like around 2001, that kind of stuff. Like, you know, when the Lakers were starting to get really good, that kind of stuff, and their three-peat. So, I mean, it's really great. You mentioned, I have that Michael Jordan jersey hanging here. I have another photo signed by him as well, hanging in my apartment. So it definitely brings more appreciation. I think it also boosted the value of those things as well. I've been following some of the stuff of like things that have been sold. Not that I am even considering that. These things are pretty near and dear to my heart. I think if I, you know, went bankrupt and had to sell all my stuff, those would be kind of the last things I would try to get rid of, even if they're, you know, some of the more valuable. But it's crazy to see some of the stuff that's been selling since that documentary came out. I think I saw a signed Jordan jersey go for like $16,000, which is crazy.
Wow. Unbelievable. Crazy stuff. So let's talk about MMA a little bit here, because this has been a interesting news week. So I kind of wrote down some of the various stories that have happened since Saturday, and we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon. So we had the Fight Island / UFC 251 announcement, Fight Island location, you know, the four dates and so on. And it's really a good looking card for UFC 251. We had the Dana White First Take interview in total, including this very interesting dialogue that he had with Dominique Foxworth regarding the fighter pay, which I thought was really fun. The whole Conor retirement thing for the third time, and this, you know, reveal that he could have fought UFC 249 if he wanted to. The announcement of DC Stipe Miocic 3 scheduled for August. And of course, we just had, you know, UFC 250 happen on Saturday and some leftovers out of that. Out of all of those, what has stuck with you the most, like the most of interest?
Oh my God, that's a really tough question to answer, man. I mean, I don't even know. It's been a crazy few weeks when you kind of put it. I mean, that's less than a few weeks. That's what, the last few days,
right?
Almost, it seems like. That's wild. I mean, I guess, like, the Conor McGregor thing, I think, kind of folds into, like, all the stuff that's been going on with Jorge Masvidal and Jon Jones, and I guess the Dana White First Take interview with Dominique Foxworth and stuff. So I think that's probably the story that's captivated the most of my interest over the past a few days, because obviously you just have these, the biggest stars in the UFC right now, more or less, you know, the, a good portion of them, in John Jones, Jorge Masvidal, and Conor McGregor, seemingly having gripes with the promotion, obviously for their own individual reasons, but seems like collectively there is, you know, something mustering. So I thought that was interesting. You're getting more media questions towards Dana White in regard to fighter pay, and this whole thing just seems like it's kind of festering and building up towards something. I don't know what that something is or what it's going to look like, but it's definitely an interesting time on that front. It seems like fighter pay is a topic of discussion and a prominent issue in the sport, rising back up in a way that we haven't seen it in a good amount of time. I almost feel like since around the time ESPN put out that fighter pay story, which I think was like 2010.
Yeah, it's a good place to start. So the interview that he did, so this is, you know, he was doing his essentially a promotional appearance to talk about the announcement of Fight Island on First Take, which is one of ESPN's more watch shows and typically a pretty soft landing spot. But Dominique Foxworth.
Does he usually, I don't know how closely you watch First Take, but is he on there often?
Dana was on there a couple weeks.
I mean Dominique.
I think he is. And I don't, honestly, I don't watch it other than when Dana does an appearance on there. But I feel like he's on there a lot, because even clips I've seen, you know, just videos that are posted on Twitter and things like that, I've recognized his face quite a bit. So I don't know. I felt like, you know, that Stephen A. Smith was on there more frequently, but I don't know if maybe they're just, you know, including him more often or what have you. But so he's a, you know, former NFL player, I guess. And so he basically, you know, he was asking from, and he mentioned this from someone that was involved, obviously, in a union playing in pro sports. That's where he was kind of coming from. And essentially, he wasn't backing down when he was asking Dana White questions about it. And you could see Dana was so put off by it. And like, I tweeted this, that his facials, Dana White's facials as he's listening to this, are just absolutely priceless. Like, even after, right as the line of questioning ends, he kind of looks off camera and just kind of gives this WTF, like, why am I being asked all this stuff on ESPN? Like, almost like he was incredulous that they would even be questioned about this. But it was a fascinating bit of dialogue between them. And it's, you know, and coming from the side of it, like we are, it's Dana, he doesn't have good answers for anything. You know, he's kind of, you hear some of these common refrains now, like everyone asks for more money. Nobody thinks that they don't make enough, and kind of just goes on this. And now he's going, you know, these guys sign contracts.
Okay.
So I say it again.
We're in a pandemic. Okay.
That's right. That's right. We're in a pandemic. Right. Yeah. That whole thing, like, he keeps going back to these lines over and over again, but it's not really speaking to the case of, and I love the fact that he was asked at the press conference about, the 16-18% or something like that, and he just kind of like blew that off. I think it might have been John that asked him about it. It's, you're right, there's more and more questions about it, and it helps when there's more and more people from the outside the MMA media bubble, because, you know, Dana doesn't, you know, dismisses MMA media pretty much quite a bit. So the fact is,
biggest wimps on earth, bro. Come on.
The biggest wimps on earth. That's right.
The losers among the losers.
Right. Oh boy. But yes, I was fascinated by it. I was so glad it happened, because I think anything, because ESPN, again, they're a partner of theirs, so you don't really expect this. But the fact that it happened was, I thought it was good to see. He should be asked some of these questions, because, again, when you have three of your top fighters and even more complaining about money, why, you know, this is a topic that deserves to be discussed. It would be discussed in other sports. Why not UFC?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure maybe he didn't expect to have it on that platform, but it's kind of interesting to see the way in which ESPN is kind of covering this. I mean, they gave Masvidal a platform to complain right as the UFC 250 pay-per-view was ongoing on Saturday. I had him on SportsCenter. So, yeah, I mean, there's something going on there on that front. And it doesn't seem like ESPN's trying to sweep it under the rug. I mean, they're giving the opportunity and kind of putting Dana White on the spot in some ways here. He has his answers. I mean, I think you could give the most intricately asked question backed up by every fact you wanted to have it, and Dana White will just say his piece. I mean, he has this thing that he does where he gets like 3, 4, 5 answers on a subject as a whole, and you kind of went over it at the top there, and he just sticks to those guns and finds a way to circle back to them and kind of use them as ammunition. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't think you're going to get anything insanely credible from Dana White in these interviews. Even if you ask him really good questions, he's not going to, you know, he's not going to admit that there's an issue with fighter pay or that fighters are getting paid too little. He's paid millions of dollars to keep all these fighters, you know, under his thumb, more or less, and make sure this kind of stuff doesn't happen and change the narrative. I mean, he's done it for years and years. So, you know, he's become pretty damn good at it in a lot of ways. And it's going to take a lot more than Dana White just getting asked some questions and interviews for this to change. But it's a good start. Mm.
And he said, and he's right about this, that, you know, if fighters want to start a union, they can do it. He's not stopping them from doing this. And that is fairly accurate. He's not. Yeah,
he made that comment before the last time. Remember when we had like the MMAAA and then the MMAFA, and he's like, these two, I think he said in an interview when he was asked about this a few years ago, he's like, there's infighting going on between these two sides. Like, the fighters can't even get on the same page in which way they want to approach this. So I'm sure he's not necessarily losing a whole lot of sleep about it given the history.
So on that interview, he talked about Fight Island and this UFC 251 card, which is I don't love using the word stacks. I think it's overused, but it is really, this is a loaded up main card if everyone stays healthy and we get through three title fights, interesting title fights at that, you know, some of the challengers, you know, I might want to see flipped around, but you know, I think we know where we're at with all this. Fight Island revealed in Abu Dhabi, which had been, you know, poorly kept secret here for the last, you know, 3-4 weeks, whatever it's been. And then we're going to get some follow-up shows after that, and the cards are starting to kind of fill out with that. That 251 show, Gilbert Burns isn't exactly, you know, the sexiest challenger. I feel terrible for Leon Edwards. This guy just, you know, he's contacted because of the travel issues out of the UK. I mean, he finally has an opportunity to get what he wants, and because of a pandemic, he can't travel to get there. I feel horrible for him. You know, the Peter Yan, Jose Aldo fight, which I think all of us would love to see. Aljamain Sterling, some Dana White magic put on that, and Aljamain Sterling getting the shot instead. And I'm sure he would have taken if it was offered, but I guess we'll have to wait for that. And then obviously we have, this rematch of Volkanovski versus Max Holloway and some other interesting fights as well. This, I think this 251 card, I give them credit that even with this, you know, pandemic going on, they are trying to put together these really, deep pay-per-views as to the best of their ability. And so far at this one, I mean, this 251 card looks really, really, really good.
Yeah, it's nice for sure. I mean, it's one of those pay-per-views that kind of like UFC 245 in December. I mean, I'll have three title fights, but it's not the, you know, magnificent champions. It's not the Jon Jones. There's no Israel Adesanya or whatever the case may be. No Conor McGregor fighting or Khabib. But it's a, you know, with the champions that are kind of mid-sellers, I guess you could call them or whatever, they're, you know, loading them all into one fight card. So if you're like a hardcore fight fan or even just a casual who's been watching UFC semi closely over the however many years, I think this is will definitely be worth your money. It'll be interesting to kind of see the whole, I mean, it's not really Fight Island. It's going to be, you know, it's not on a beach. There's not going to be palm trees in the background. I think that whole imagery that some people are putting together in their minds is pretty not even close to what the accurate reflection of it's going to be. But in terms of the actual fight card, it's very good. I mean, you got Paige VanZant coming back, so she's got some name value there. Obviously, Rose Namajunas and Jessica Andrade doing the rematch too. That's great, but yeah, in terms of the title fights, I think they just kind of had to do what they had to do. I thought I'm completely fine with the Volkanovski-Holloway rematch. That's a fight they were obviously planning on doing already in June in Australia before things got switched around. So I'm kind of glad they stuck to their guns there, and I'm curious to see how Max comes back after losing the belt. It's going to be pretty interesting to him. I mean, especially if he were to lose this fight, that would be three losses in four fights for Max Holloway, which would be a pretty surprising turn after he put together like 13 in a row or something. Yeah. So yeah, that one has my eye, but obviously the Usman Burns fight is kind of the interesting one there to me. Gilbert Burns 100% deserves this title shot, in my opinion. Like, I don't think saying he's not a deserving contender would be wrong. He's just not the contender we wanted to see the most. There's three completely legitimate title shot options in the welterweight division, and Masvidal, Leon Edwards, and Burns. They all earned their crack with various wins and putting together their streaks and all that kind of stuff for different reasons. It's just title challenger 1A was Jorge Masvidal, and we had to move on to, you know, 1B was Leon Edwards. He can take the fight again, which I'm kind of glad he didn't. He's already lost to Kamaru Usman to go back and take that fight on like a month's notice when, I mean, I think if Leon Edwards is going to be fighting Kamaru Usman, he needs to be bringing in super high-level wrestlers from wherever he needs to in the world, needs to be putting something pretty extensive together to be fully prepared for that fight if he wants to win. So I think taking a title shot against Usman on like a month's notice wouldn't have been in his best interest. And then you have Gilbert Burns, who kind of flipped the script, is a training partner of Usman and has, you know, felt him in the gym numerous times, so he knows exactly what he's getting himself into. So I think that, to me, out of the three title fights, even though it's not the one we wanted, is among the most fascinating. I still love that Usman Burns fight. It's just unfortunate that they couldn't get Masvidal done, because that was the fight to make.
Yeah. Tell me about covering shows in Abu Dhabi, because I know that you, you've been there. And for those that obviously haven't been there, which I assume is pretty much everyone listening, tell me about the experience of covering shows there. I know it's obviously very hot, but I guess talk to us a little bit about that experience and what it's like.
Yeah, I mean, so I've only done the one, and that was UFC 242 in Abu Dhabi in September. And I guess the one that they had in 2010, the original trip, UFC 112, was on Yas Island, where I guess is going to be like the UFC bubble that they're going to be setting up for this fight week, or the various fight weeks that they're going to have, 4 and 2 weeks or whatever the case is there. So I don't know exactly what it's like, you know, covering on Yas Island. We were there during the UFC 242 week. They had one of their media events leading up to it on that part of the city or the country, or I don't even know what you call that whole area.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, like, it was crazy hot when we were there. Like, it was absolutely insane. Walking from the inside of the hotel to the Uber, like right out front, you would be sweating in like that 2 seconds. It was just absolutely brutal. And the fight night was insanely hot. In that venue that they had just basically built for that event, the air conditioning wasn't working completely well. So, like, I was dying on press row. You can see me on the broadcast up there, just like, you know, air dry myself with my shirt, just trying not to sweat like crazy. My computer was like boiling, and I couldn't imagine what it was like to actually then be in the cage fighting with the light shining down on you. And it's supposed to be even hotter during this fight week, or these weeks coming up in July. So I don't know, man. Like, it was an experience that I enjoyed for sure, like just traveling to that part of the world and just seeing, you know, the different culture, and then going through that fight week. Obviously, you know, I was there, I was working pretty closely with Dustin Poirier in the lead up to that, and just seeing everything that he experienced in terms of being welcomed and like kind of going to his place and doing, you know, a private interview with him in the lead up. There's some really cool things, but I imagine covering these events is going to be a drastic change for everyone in terms of what we got. I mean, covering these fight cards is so different now than what it was a few months ago. You have these interactive media days where you know, you're just asking the fighters questions over a stream, where you're in a queue and you know, the UFC PR people bring you in. You go to weigh-ins and you're far away from everyone. There's no ceremonial weigh-ins. Basically, the only time you actually get to see or talk to the fighters face-to-face is fight night. And that's if you're in the back, you're still social distanced away from them. So, I mean, I find that right now almost covering these ones from home is it's like not much of a lesser experience. It's basically the fight night is what you're missing out on. If you're cage side, obviously you get to watch the fights there. If you're in the back, you get to ask the fighters the questions. But I don't really feel like I'm missing out on a ton. And I guess that's probably going to be the same protocols in terms of their fight week procedures for these Abu Dhabi cards. So besides the fact that we're probably going to have to wake up at some weird hours to accommodate for like weigh-ins and stuff like that, mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to be anything different too much than what we've just had in these recent fight cards, which is, you know, nothing, not too much exposure. I know the fighters love it because they don't have to do crazy media rounds and stuff like that, yeah. And do all these face-to-faces, but yeah, it's nothing too too in-depth these days, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's wild that the prelims are going to start like 2 a.m. local time.
Yeah, man. Well, I've endured that. So when we did the Manchester pay-per-view, which I can't remember off the top of my head, UFC 208 or something, was it? Or yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
When Bisping fought Dan Henderson, and they had basically the same setup in terms of timing as it's going to be for this one. I think the main event, when Bisping and Henderson walked to the cage, it was like 5:30 in the morning in Manchester. It was crazy. Like we reported to the venue for the first fight, I think at 10:45 at night.
Wow.
Just like insane. And then like, you know, the main card kicks off at 3 a.m. and it was a bizarre experience. Like I basically just stayed on normal time when I went over there. So yeah. It's going to be an interesting experience for those people there. I mean, if you're a media member, I don't know what our plans are at MMA Junkie at the moment. We do have Farah Hanoun, who's on that part of the world. She lives in Egypt and has family in Abu Dhabi, and she came and hung out with us for that last one and covered us. So I assume maybe she'll be there. Maybe John Morgan will be going. But even if you're there, like the experience of, you know, you're probably going to be in your hotel room 90% of the time. So it's going to be, I guess it'll give you some time to get on a comfortable sleep schedule.
DC Stipe 3 coming up in mid-August. That was confirmed by Dana White the other day in that same ESPN interview. And I mean, there's so many, I'm glad that we finally have a date, because I really kind of want to get past this and see what we have with Francis Ngannou, who he's going to fight next, and kind of how the situation works out. I'm really looking forward to this DC Cormier fight, because I mean, it's crazy. I was kind of just looking back, like the only person Miocic has fought in the past two fights has been Daniel Cormier. And other than Derek Lewis, it's basically just been Stipe for DC. And this trilogy that we didn't really ever expect maybe we're going to get has just kind of unfolded over the last 2 years. And we're finally going to get the conclusion here in a couple months. Do you feel like the winner of this is the best UFC heavyweight of all time? Because it feels like that's also on the line here.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair thing to say. I think a lot of people already regard Stipe Miocic as that in terms of the resume he's put together. So you look at what Daniel Cormier has done between his Strikeforce career and his UFC run and everything. I think it's very justifiable to put him very, very high up there, especially if he gets two wins over Stipe. That'd be pretty big for him. I think he's like 11-1 or 12-1 as a heavyweight. Obviously, the lone loss is that fight to Stipe. So if he can avenge that and get it back. If you kind of look at the two fights, he's basically won 90% of the fight time. I mean, the only time that it's gone badly for him is when Stipe started ripping him with those body shots and he didn't know how to answer. So if Cormier can go in there, and whether it's a 5-round dominant decision or he finishes in the first or whatever, like he can say, I fought Stipe Miocic, you know, three times and I won 11 of the 12 rounds, got finished in the lone round that I didn't win. So that's a pretty big claim on Cormier's side. So yeah, to answer your question, I think that would be a very, very fair distinction to make.
And we'll see what happens afterwards. Obviously, if Miocic wins, I mean, it's hard to deny that Francis Ngannou is going to be the next guy in line, and there's intrigue.
Is it unrealistic to think both of these guys could retire, win or lose, no matter who wins or who loses this trilogy? It's entirely possible.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think it is very possible, because obviously Cormier, we assume that this is going to be it, because all the talk has been that this will be it. Of course, you never know, but that kind of seems to be the way that things are going. But Miocic, you're right. I think with why I think it's definitely more possible is because he has this other life that is very important to him. And I think he's made really good money. Probably obviously not as much money as he should have made, but he's made really good money these past couple of fights. I'm sure he's going to do really well for this. And he is the exact opposite of Floyd Mayweather in that he does not live an extravagant lifestyle. He's a firefighter on the side, has a young family. And I think he'd be good being a firefighter the rest of his life. And I don't know if this is, I think fighting is something he does, but the impression I get is it's not the only thing driving him in his life, that his family and his friends and his career as a firefighter seems to be more important to him. That's what I kind of guess. So I would not be surprised at all if this is it for both guys. And then, you know, that opens up some very interesting things for, you know, obviously who Ngannou would fight for the vacant title if that is to happen.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure who that'd be, but I think it all kind of makes sense there, especially the stuff with Stipe. I mean, he obviously went through a serious eye injury too coming into this. I know he's been cleared and everything, but who knows what the lingering effects are. I know he was, if it didn't get better, he was willing to walk away at this point. So like if it was going to continue to cause him issues, he obviously feels comfortable enough. So yeah, if he makes a nice payday, like I don't know. Besides continuing to fight and making more money, I don't really know what more there is for him to accomplish. Like, I wouldn't be jumping out of my seat to be fighting Francis Ngannou again, especially when you already beat him. Like, what's really the upside for you on that one? You have a convincing win over him. Obviously, Francis has improved and everything, and to go out there and do that again would be impressive, but wouldn't really answer any more questions that we don't have about Francis. Like, we know that if he hits you, you're getting really messed up, but we still, in this four fight stretch that he's had since Stipe, we haven't seen him have to defend a takedown. We haven't seen him have to do all these things that caused him the major issues and led to the loss against Stipe. So I guess for Stipe to go out there and, you know, get through that early knockout stage and be able to, you know, expose those flaws again would be a statement. But I mean, if you're looking at it from his side, I don't really see that doesn't enhance your legacy a whole lot. So for him to go out and retire Daniel Cormier, he's 38 years old. He's done his thing in the sport for a long time as well. So it would not surprise me if he got a double retirement. And then I guess it leaves us open to a new phase in heavyweight history. And I'm sure looking at the lay of the land, Francis Ngannou would feel pretty good about his chances to handle that division for a good time to come.
Boy, it's too bad we couldn't get a Francis Ngannou, John Jones fight for the vacant heavyweight title if that was to happen.
I mean,
right?
That would seem, and I think the UFC would be more willing to pay up for John Jones to move to heavyweight if that were the case. But I think that's maybe one of their concerns about, you know, him giving him all that money he wants to go up and fight Ngannou there. They don't know his long-term plan. Is he going to stay at heavyweight? Is he going to drop back down? Then you just wiped out one of their top contenders, the most sellable guys. So there's a lot of elements that go into that whole issue they have. But I think definitely a belt being on the line changes the complexion of John Jones going to heavyweight and the UFC's willingness to put money on the table for it.
Good point. Were you as nonplussed, I guess is the term, about the Conor McGregor retirement for the third time as I was?
Oh my God. I was like, that happened because we're trying to get through all our fight night coverage and everything. We're just doing that. And someone drops that tweet in our company Slack channel. And I'm just like, can we just tell Conor to F off? Like, not right now. It's like anytime, but right now, this is not what I need to deal with. But I don't know. I'm not putting too much stock into it. I mean, I think even with what he said to Ariel in their interview after the fact, he didn't really make it seem like this is definitive. He basically just said there's nothing out there that interests me right now. So I guess you could say Conor McGregor is retired until he fights again.
Yeah. I mean, this is the third
time.
Like
everyone else.
I know. It's the third time he's done this all on social media. And it just, the timing of it was, you know, again, just as the event ended. I don't think nobody buys it at all. And it's a story because people like to click on stuff. They like to check things out. You can't fully ignore it. But I think deep down, most fans are kind of like, he'll be back next year when there's crowds and when he can do an $18 million gate or something like that. And I think he's pissed off that he didn't get his way and wanted to fight Gaethje and wanted to be kind of dictate his own terms. But, and he's probably, you know, who knows who he's trying to make the Masvidal fight, who knows what was kind of happening behind the scenes, but that there just wasn't in a real fight that interested in him. So he's like kind of interested in rather. So he's kind of like, yeah, whatever. I'll just take some time off. And Dana White, you know, said as much. He's just like, look, if I was Conor, I'd just sit back, see how this whole thing plays out and then go from there. And, you know, Dana's talked in the past about, he, you know, about Conor potentially fighting at a Fight Island or something like that, that he would really miss having a Conor McGregor gate. And there's no joke. If you look at those numbers that he draws, not just on pay-per-view, but at the box office, they're huge. They're some of the UFC's best of all time. And to be able to, you know, they want to do this the right way. And I have no doubt he'll be back. And it's, I think everyone deep down thinks the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's probably likely. The one thing I don't like about it is I think right now, as we've shown, or history has shown with Conor McGregor, giving him time to sit on his hands more or less is not a good thing. It leads to him making bad decisions and bad things happening. So, Yeah, that's why I was really liking when he came out and said before the Cerrone fight, you know, I have the plans for this 2020 season. I want to fight three times. I want to do this. I want to do that. It sounded like there was a lot of structure to it, and it really was helping him generate that new quote-unquote Conor McGregor image that everyone was so fond of going into and coming out of the Cerrone fight. So that's the one part that does have some concern. I mean, are you willing to trade a gate now to get Conor McGregor a fight and allow him to, you know, keep his head in the game and stay on schedule? And if you keep him out, maybe something happens, you know, in the months leading up to when you want him back, and then it delays him getting back and all these different elements. So if at all possible, I think it would be in the UFC's best interest to keep Conor McGregor fighting. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, it sucks that you're not going to get that, you know, $8 to $20 million gate, whatever the range is, depending on the venue you go to and the prices you set. But it's not like the UFC isn't making hundreds of millions of dollars anyways. So it's not like, you know, I can't really get too upset for them for losing out on this gate money. Like, there's other ways to make it work.
But we're in a pandemic.
Exactly. Well, everyone's going crazy. We're in a pandemic. Connor's just, you know, who knows what to believe these days.
That's right. I had known this, but I need to kind of have it like put in front of me to really kind of have it sink in. He's only fought twice since 2017. Or since November 2016, the Eddie Alvarez fight. That MMA-wise, not counting the Mayweather fight. That's wild that he still gains that much interest and that much buzz. And he's only fought twice. He's 1-1-1. Like, it's amazing. We just have not seen him. We just haven't seen him at all, really. It's crazy.
Yeah, he is the king. I mean, that's one thing that him and Floyd Mayweather definitely have in common. They do not have to be competing actively to keep their names in the headline. They can drop one tweet. He can put out his little goat thread that he put out a couple weeks ago and do a million different things in his arsenal to keep his name in the headlines. Some of those things, as we've seen, have been for the worse, like, you know, hitting a elderly gentleman in a bar, and, you know, the bus attack infamous in Brooklyn and all that kind of stuff. All those decisions haven't been good to keep his name in the headlines, but he is very capable. He can post one little tweet. He can call one person out. He can do all these different little tactics, and it keeps him extremely relevant in the sport. And that's something I think, as we saw with Floyd Mayweather's career as well, that he was very good at doing too.
Final question, news of the week. Obviously, you know, everyone's talked about UFC 250 a lot, and the main story coming out of it seems to be the excitement over bantamweight, and that there's a interesting line of contenders, an interesting group of fights you could make. Obviously, we will have our new bantamweight champion crowned in just over a month's time, and we talked a little bit about that, but there's, you know, with Cody Garbrandt and Sugar Sean O'Malley, and you have obviously Aljamain Sterling, really the rightful number one contender, should be getting that shot, but he's not. And you just look up and down the stack. I mean, there's interesting names, interesting fights to be made. Mara Moraes is kind of the number one contender, but he's kind of the guy that's left on the outside looking in. You know, what's going to happen with him? There's a lot of interesting fights up and down the stack to be made, and my hope is that they can really make some of them, because I think 135 is a lot of fun, even for the guys coming off losses. Like someone like a Dominic Cruz is still a valuable name. There's Rob Font out there who's always looking for an interesting fight. He's 135 is it really has emerged as a really fun division. I thought Saturday was a great showcase of that.
Yeah, 135 is amazing. I've been high on that weight class for a long time, and I think obviously it's really starting to come into its peak now, but I think it's been great. We'll get TJ Dillashaw back in like 7 or so months as well too, and he'll be an immediate factor in that weight class. Maybe that's the opponent Moraes faces. But yeah, Sean Shelby, the UFC matchmaker, has done an incredible job of putting this division together and building it into what it is today. I think there's been some disappointments over like the years in terms of champions holding up the belts. Obviously, everything Dominic Cruz went through when he was champion, and then took a while for Cody Garbrandt to get in there and defend that belt after winning. And obviously, TJ Dillashaw moving down a weight class and then being stripped. And now we had Henry Cejudo out a long time giving up the belt. So there's been a lot of turbulence. It would be nice to have like a some stability in terms of a champion or just getting title fights in there consistently. So we'll see what happens coming up now. But yeah, there's so much to be excited about in that weight class. And I think Sean O'Malley definitely is going to be one of those guys that I think in a couple fights is going to be in that top five, you know, really competing with those guys. I was pretty blown away by what he did against Eddie Wineland. I was going on all these pro Eddie Wineland conquests in the lead up to that fight, not saying that he was going to win or anything, but that he was, I thought, being disrespected by the fans and like people who maybe just weren't aware that this guy was the first WEC champion, mm-hmm. had been around the game for such a long time, and that people were saying, you know, Sean O'Malley's fighting a can or the UFC's setting up for an easy win. I was like, that is so far from being true. Even if Sean O'Malley goes in there and dusts Eddie Wineland in 2 minutes, which is more or less what ended up happening, that says more about Sean O'Malley than it does about Eddie Wineland. So I'm pretty sold on Sugar Sean after that performance he had, and I'm sure a lot of people are as well.
Yeah, I think the big loser in a lot of this is Henry Cejudo, in that, you know, he's leaving at a time when the division is super hot, and, you know, for a guy, usually, you know, most champions, if they're going to vacate, there's kind of a big push to, you know, stay. And I wish he hadn't retired, because it's just, I think there's a slew of interesting fights, could have made a lot of money. Obviously he has a dollar figure that he would like to see, but I don't know. After this weekend, I think there's a lot of interest in this upper echelon, and guys are just really just not only took the spot, they grabbed the spot. And are like, okay, if you're going to leave, then we're just going to take it. And I mean, we'll see how the Peter Yan Aldo fight turns out. But we're set up probably for the next easily 6 months, 8 months or longer with interesting fights for that top contender spot and also for the championship as well.
Yeah, and it's tough to say. I hate like saying I want someone to win or this, that, or the other thing. But Peter Yan beating Aldo would probably be the best for the division. Just Aldo's an older guy. Even when he was at his very peak, he fought like twice a year. Yeah. Peter Yan is a freaking machine. That guy wants to fight every 2 months, every 3 months. I don't think it's going to change drastically if he gets the belt. So, yeah, I mean, I think for the sake of getting the stuff fleshed out, Peter Yan winning is good. Obviously, Aldo kind of has the bigger name and could be the more sellable champion in certain ways, but I just worry about his consistency, especially when you throw that cut to 135 in there. I don't think that's something he wants to be doing, nor should he be doing more than like, you know, once, twice a year.
Yeah. Anything you excited for on Saturday? This card is very thin, to say the least.
No, could I say that? I mean, yeah. I don't know. It's definitely a struggle. I mean, Andre Feely versus Charles Jourdain is probably my most interesting fight, just because Jourdain's a Canadian guy, supposed to be, you know, we've struggled to get these Canadians cranking out here. Obviously, Felicia Spencer was our championship hope, and that was probably the steepest uphill climb anyone could ask for in a title fight on her front. So I wasn't really expecting her to put us back on the top of the heap, but I think Jourdain's a guy with some potential, and anytime Andre Feely fights, it's a banger. So that's something to get excited about, I guess, if you're putting a gun to my head and making me pick one thing on there. But yeah, that main event is big time struggle city. I don't know what to say besides, sometimes, as my mother said, you know, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything about it.
Yeah, I would say MMA fans, if you have the opportunity to take someone out on a date Saturday night, you want to take the wife out of the house, the husband, whatever it is.
I don't even have that option. We're in lockdown, so I will be watching this as much as I may want to crap on it. I don't really have any other options.
Exactly. Oh, there you go. There you go. So, yeah, it's entertainment for somebody. But, yeah, it's yeesh. Anyway, so before I let you go, obviously you write for MMA Junkie, but I want to obviously give you the chance to share your social media, stuff that's coming up you want people to check out, past stuff. The floor is yours.
Yeah, man. Just obviously follow me, Mike Bond MMA, on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, we have stuff coming up on MMA Junkie. Obviously, we're fortunate enough to still have people in Las Vegas during this event stretch. So we've been able to still do some modicum of on-site coverage. So yeah, I guess just keep it locked there. Obviously, my stuff pops up there pretty frequently. And, you know, just trying to get through these crazy times. It was a weird stretch there with no events for like 2 months, but now we are back to normal life of having UFC every single weekend, even if the card's strength isn't what we're quite used to and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, we drudge on.
Certainly do with main events like this weekend too. Yikes. Mike Bond, thanks so much for stopping by and best of luck.
Yeah, you too, man. Thanks so much for having me back.
All right. Big thanks to Mike Bond for stopping by. And also big thanks to Jason Powell for being available and stopping by on Thursday's show. So yeah, no shortage of audio to listen to. If you have not listened to the Jason Powell interview, I would greatly recommend it, as I do obviously all my podcasts, because they are all A+, top level, high rank, whatever you want to call it. They're the best. And you guys are the best for listening to them. But yeah, it was an interesting conversation with Mike, and we have a kind of a Basura card this weekend coming up. Boy, it is not exactly star-studded. We talked about it very, very, very lightly on the show. But yeah, when you have this many events, and this is, you know, a broken record, but I mean, we've talked about the amount of events the UFC puts on and the light cards. Imagine that during a pandemic, and that's what we're doing right now. And we have a bunch of other fight cards coming. If you look at the schedule coming up, is week after week after week after week. It's crazy. So as much as we're looking forward to UFC 251 and kind of seeing what happens with this Fight Island deal, there is some very light shows when it comes to star power and not even like contender power, I would say. It's not good. So, you know, enjoy this weekend or enjoy Saturday if you can. But feel free to skip this one, I think. There'll probably be some good fights on it, but overall, not exactly the best of cards. We're going to call it good. Been talking to you guys for quite a bit here the past couple of days, so we'll call it good here. Yeah, we'll have more next week. I don't know who, don't know how, but we will somehow get there, you and I. Big thanks to Mike Bond. Thanks to all you guys for listening. You have a lot of choice in your podcast day. I greatly appreciate the time you spend with myself or anyone here at WrestlingObserver.com. Greatly appreciate it. You guys are great. And this has been Josh Nason. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.